From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We continue our end-of-the-decade series today with more interviews of the 80s from the Fresh Air Archives. Composer John Cage shares some of his timeless ideas about music and art in an interview recorded in 1982. Also, composer David Del Tredici tells us why he returned to tonality. Del Tredici won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1980. And actor and playwright Wallace Shawn shows us that he's not the person you'd assume him to be from his 1981 movie My Dinner with Andre. The end of the decade brought a new baby to Fresh Air's linguist Jeffrey Nunberg and his wife. We find out how this word-conscious couple went about naming their daughter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Family and friends of U.S. servicemen gathered today to mourn the young men from their communities who went off to fight in Panama last week and died for their country. Three servicemen were buried today. They were among more than 20 American servicemen who have been killed so far during the U.S. invasion of Panama. Two American civilians also died in the assault to oust Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega. More than 300 servicemen have been injured in the fighting. The U.S. Justice Department today asked authorities in four European countries to freeze bank accounts of ousted Panamanian leader General Manuel Noriega. U.S. officials believe the accounts were used by Noriega to stash millions of dollars in illegal drug profits. Even as authorities made the request to freeze some of Noriega's assets, officials in Panama and the U.S. negotiated with the Vatican for the release of Noriega. Egypt and Syria have restored diplomatic relations, ending a 12-year rift which began after former Egyptian President Anwar Sadat's visit to Jerusalem in 1977. Larry James has more from Cairo.
The announcement, which was released simultaneously in Cairo and Damascus, said the two heads of state would meet in early January, but did not say where. The communique was issued following a two-hour meeting between Egyptian Prime Minister Atif Sedki and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad in Damascus. It said the two countries had agreed to renew ties in the light of what it called current international developments and their expected impact on the Arab nations. Libya is the only other Arab country which has not renewed diplomatic relations with Egypt. But Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has met with Libya's Muammar Gaddafi three times since October in what both governments have said are the first steps at resuming normal ties. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the crash of a commuter in Washington State last night, a commuter plane, in Washington State last night. All six people on board the plane were killed. Carol Levinson reports.
The United Express turboprop was flying from Seattle to Pasco, Washington, in the eastern part of the state, when it landed short of the runway and burst into flames. The two crew members and four passengers were killed. The National Transportation Safety Board has begun an investigation, but an airline spokesman says so far there's no indication of what caused the crash. Weather conditions were not bad, and the airline says no unusual radio transmission occurred. The British Aerospace plane was delivered new to United Express 2 years ago. This is the first fatality for the two-year-old commuter airline, which serves the Pacific Northwest. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson reporting.
General Motors today announced indefinite layoffs for more than 2,000 workers. The plants make the Beretta and Corsica models. Both cars have posted weak sales. The layoffs will affect workers at GM plants in Linden, New Jersey, and Wilmington, Delaware. U.S. auto sales fell more than 25% in the early part of the month. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 15 points to close at 2724.40. This is NPR. Mexico today denied allegations by U.S. officials that its territory has been used by Cuba to transport weapons to leftist rebels in El Salvador. U.S. officials have said that there are strong indications that Cuban-supplied weaponry is being sent to the Salvadoran guerrillas through a remote route that begins in the Yucatan Peninsula. A Mexican official has categorically rejected the allegation because, he says, Mexico has built up a surveillance infrastructure to avoid the use of its territory for such purposes. Romanians today viewed an uncut version of the secret trial of the late Romanian president Nicolae Ceaușescu, who was killed on Christmas Day by firing squads. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Bucharest that the videotape has been screened every few hours on Romanian television.
The videotape tape of the secret trial of Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife has attracted intense interest in Romania. It shows the pair defiantly arguing with their accusers. Ceaușescu claims that his accusers are part of a plot to destroy Romania. He would not respond to charges that he ordered people killed at the beginning of the uprising in the city of Timișoara. He claimed they had no proof of charges, that Ceaușescu and his wife stole money from the Romanian people to amass their personal fortune. The videotape is seen as part of a tactic to put the vengeful passions of the past week aside and allow the government to get on with the business of preparing for elections in April. One official said today, "The one thing we must avoid at all costs is a witch hunt and a bloodbath." This is John Hockenberry in Bucharest.
The Lebanese government today appealed to all kidnappers in Lebanon to release their hostages. 18 Westerners, including 8 Americans, are being held there. The hostage held the longest is Terry Anderson, chief Middle East correspondent of the Associated Press. He was abducted in March of 1985. In a separate development, a high-ranking Iranian envoy called for a ceasefire late in the day today to bring to a halt 5 days of fighting there between rival Shiite Muslim militias in South Lebanon. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're continuing our end-of-the-decade series featuring interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Coming up, we'll hear from two composers, John Cage, a pioneer of experimental music, and David Del Tredici, who has led a return to tonality. I spoke with John Cage in 1982, back when Fresh Air was a local program broadcast in Philadelphia. The occasion was Cage's 70th birthday. John Cage has devoted his life to challenging our preconceptions about music and art. Cage studied composition and 12-tone music with Arnold Schoenberg in the early 1930s. But instead of pursuing Schoenberg's vision of a new order in music, Cage eventually abandoned the idea of order altogether in favor of composing through chance processes. He used chance-generated music to release his art from the limits of his own taste, memory, and emotions. Before we hear from him, why don't we listen to a piece that combines Cage's interest in Eastern philosophy, chance processes, and electronics. This is from Indeterminacy, in which Cage tells 90 stories in 90 minutes. The piano and electronic music score was composed and realized by David Tudor. Cage and Tudor allow the voice and music to collide and let the music sometimes drown out the voice.
I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount."
If I may quote you from one of your books, you wrote, "What was it that actually made me choose music rather than painting? Just because they said nicer things about my music than they did about my paintings? But I don't have absolute pitch. I can't keep a tune. In fact, I have no talent for music. The last time I saw her, Aunt Phoebe said, 'You're in the wrong profession.'"
Right.
Why did you choose, did you really feel that way about your music? And if so, why did you choose music over painting?
Well, my father was an inventor. And I've never thought that, as many people do, that music should be in my head. And that I should learn how to write down what I already hear. I really can't hold a tune. And I don't know solfège at all. So that I found ways of writing music to produce sounds that I haven't heard and that other people haven't heard. If I'd studied solfège, if I had a feeling for harmony, which I don't, I think I would simply write what people have already heard or what I would have thought I heard. The result is I have a curious feeling every time I write a new piece, particularly one for orchestra that involves so many people and so much trouble, you know, to bring it into existence. I think up until the last minute that maybe it's just going to be a great mistake or that we won't discover anything with it.
So you have to listen to your pieces as they're being done in probably a different way than most composers listen to
their
work.
I hear them for the first time, and I hear them with interest rather than critically. I try to hear what there is to hear.
So you won't walk away thinking, that was a real success, or that was a terrible failure, I won't do that again.
No, not that.
I think when you were studying with Schoenberg, and this is an indirect quote, he said something like, you don't have an ear for harmonies, and that will always be for you like walking against, like knocking into a wall. And you said, in that case, I'll bang my head against that wall for the rest of my career.
Right.
And a lot of your work hasn't been about that relationship of sounds to other sounds, but of sounds in and of themselves, individual sound, sound for itself. Is that too, do you think, from not wanting to work with harmony?
I had an interest in each single sound from the beginning. At first, I began putting the sounds together into, as I'd been taught, into motives and repeating them and varying them. But gradually, and through a study of Oriental philosophy, and through the use of chance operations, I have found ways, I think, of letting sounds move from their own centers rather than centers in my mind.
What's your attitude towards random sounds in your home? I'm thinking now of...
I just love them.
Uh-huh, like apartments in Manhattan, which is probably the noisiest city in the world.
I live on, and Sixth Avenue is very, very noisy. And sometimes there's burglar alarms.
Oh, yeah.
And they may last 3 or 4 hours. That's quite a problem. I think that we almost have an instinct to be annoyed by a burglar alarm. But as I pay attention to them, they're curiously slightly varying.
What if you're paying attention to something else at the same time?
Well, I think that one of our most accessible disciplines now is paying attention to more than one thing at a time. And if we can do that with equanimity, then I would suggest paying attention to 3 things at the same time. And you can practice that as a discipline. I think it's more effective than sitting cross-legged. I mean to say cross-legged in relation
to... In meditation.
Yes. It opens the... I think the meaning of meditation is to open the doors of the ego from a concentration on itself to a flow with all of creation, wouldn't you say? And if we can do this through the sense perceptions, through multiplying the things to which we're able at one and the same time to pay attention, I think we accomplish much the same thing. At least that's my faith.
You said at one point that your problems in your performances were becoming not musical but social, and that you saw composing as a way of instructing people's behavior, controlling people's behavior, and you wanted to get out of that. So what's the difference between composing and having people perform it, composing through like traditional methods, and composing through chance? Is it a different way of shaping someone's behavior when you're working through chance processes?
No, chance is one thing, and working with music as though it were a social situation that was a desirable social situation is something else, and has led me to think of what we call indeterminacy. In other words, making my music so that it doesn't force the performers of it into a particular groove, but which gives them some space in which they can breathe and do their own work with a degree of originality.
You've like rejected taste and memory in the chance processes work. What's restricting about taste and memory for you?
There's a beautiful remark of Marcel Duchamp: to reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another the memory imprint. And I think the trouble with memory, both from a poetic point of view, is made clear too by the remark of René Char, the French poet, that each act is virgin, even the repeated one. To see things as being new rather than things that we already know before we're experiencing them. I think this is one of the things that leads to trouble between two people when someone says of another person, I knew what she would say, or I knew what he would say. I would hope that we don't get into that frame of mind with respect to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you have such a really rich and detailed memory and use it so beautifully in your storytelling and in your writings, which become your pieces also. Mm. I know that memory does come into play.
There's another remark I've come across in the last year or so that I like, and it's by the composer Erik Satie. And it's related to that remark that I just quoted from Char, each act is virgin. Satie says, experience is a form of paralysis. Do you see the relation? If we think we know what the other person is going to say, and if we don't approach things as virgin, then our minds and our attitudes to our life become paralyzed. And that's why we want to have each thing new. To realize that two Coca-Cola bottles are not identical. And what makes them not identical is that they're not at the same point. They can't be at the same point in space. Since they're not at the same point in space, they automatically receive, each one receives light differently than the other, so that it can be as fascinating as going to a museum to look carefully, attentively at two Coca-Cola bottles. And something of that is implicit in a great deal of 20th century art.
That kind of perception, I think sometimes, like when you walk into a museum or a concert hall, it's like your senses get turned on because you're gonna be you're paying money, you're walking in, you're going here especially to experience something sensual. Whereas when you go to work in the morning or when you're going to take the subway or something, you kind of turn down a lot of those senses. You're not expecting a sensual experience, and you're maybe expecting things that you're not going to want to see or hear too much.
It's marvelous, though, when we are surprised by coincidences of light or sound and our presence. That's one of the beautiful things about hunting mushrooms, is that they grow up and are fresh at just a particular moment. And our lives are actually characterized by moments.
I think your life is like this great dialectic between things like between computers and the I Ching, or between having to know what mushroom to pick so that you don't kill yourself and your friends by doing the poisonous one, and then using chance processes for your music and poetry. Do you consciously decide which each of those will be, or do you just kind of naturally have those interests in
I think we
both
should,
sides?
We can tell rather clearly when we're in what the Indians call an artha circumstance, which is a circumstance where you have a goal and you don't want to kill yourself, or you want to win as in a game, or you want to cross the street without getting killed, or you want to hunt wild mushrooms and not kill yourself, and so on. That's one way of living. Another way of living is having and giving pleasure, comma. And another way is following the good rather than the evil. I think which is dharma in Indian philosophy, is very close to what in Christianity is faith, hope, and charity, such things. And then in Buddhism there is moksha, which is liberation from all those three concerns. And normally if we went to school, we would think, well, we start in artha, we go to kama, we go to dharma, and we graduate and get into moksha. But I think the truth of the matter is that we're in all four all of the time, and that we live a life characterized by inconsistency.
I like to think of you and Marcel Duchamp playing chess together. because here...
Well, we actually didn't play
much. You didn't
play?
No,
no.
Oh.
I played with Tini Duchamp, his wife, and he would criticize our game. And he said to me once, he said, "Don't you ever want to win?"
Yeah, did you play to win when you played chess?
I didn't then. I played chess in order to be with him. I wanted to be with him as much as possible. Now that he's dead, my game has improved.
Did you talk much during those chess games with Tini? Talk with
No, I had a kind of confidence that if I was just near Duchamp, that would be enough, that I didn't have to ask him questions or converse. Once I remember he said, "Let's sit down and have a conversation." We sat down, and I don't remember what we talked about. I just liked being with him.
Was that so, that being with him and not talking got for you some of what you wanted to be around
for? Yes, I think his presence, his being, was both question and answer. Hmm?
John Cage, recorded in 1982. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives with composer David Del Tredici. John Cage is a father of experimental music. In the 1970s and 80s, Del Tredici has been at the forefront of a return to tonality. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
In composer David Del Tredici's press photo, he appears in a T-shirt emblazoned with the words, "Tonality Lives." Del Tredici composes lush, lyrical, orchestral music. He studied serial music, but he began writing tonal music when he started writing settings for the text of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. His 1976 piece, Final Alice, is considered a breakthrough work in what's been called the return to tonality. I spoke with Del Tredici in November of 1987. We opened with an excerpt of his composition, In Memory of a Summer Day, based on the preface to Through the Looking Glass. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1980.
Composers breathed was atonal. That was somehow, without anyone really saying it, the only way to go. And here I was suddenly writing long stretches in D major with very lush, romantic, Straussian Mahler melodies. This just seemed madness in a certain kind of way. Yet at the same time, it came out of my basic instinctual response to music. I was excited. This is what there was. So I had to, in a sense, go with that. On the other hand, my appraising eye saw that it was very much against what was acceptable at that time.
Which was what?
A kind of atonal, dissonant world. That's what modern music was supposed to be. Contemporary music was dissonant, as far as anyone knew. And no one anticipated the fact that somehow going backwards, that is, towards tonality, would be going forwards.
And when we say tonality, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, when I mean tonality, I mean, in my case, really very functional tonality, the language of Mahler, of Strauss, the romantic vocabulary of chords that everyone is familiar with.
Now, you're also working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic, yes?
Right. In fact, that commission is a co-commission with the Royal Philharmonic of London. Yes, it is a non-Alice text, though it is a childhood poem, something called The Spider and the Fly by Mary Howitt.
Did the orchestras give you any specs when they commissioned the piece?
They just pray to God it won't be too long. Although in this case, Zubin Mehta and the Philharmonic have been most generous. And I said, can I have a chorus? Of course. Can I have two singers? Yes. Can it be any length? Of course. So they've been quite dreamy about it.
When you get a commission, do you have a day of elation followed by a prolonged period of panic?
Right, exactly. You sound like you've written a piece. That's it. One is thrilled with the idea of the commission. It's not so much panic sets in, but the long, arduous, quite lonely hours, days, almost years that it takes to make a piece happen. And I don't think people ever realize how much energy is involved in doing that and how, at least for myself, I can't do anything else. I always say I can run my life, do all those things, or compose. When I'm composing, that's about all I can do.
I think one of the most difficult things for me to imagine is how a composer can sit at the piano and score for an entire orchestra and imagine an entire orchestra performing the piece.
Well, Terry, that is, you put your finger on a very fascinating, impossible, and challenging thing. Orchestrating is a very calculated risk. I mean, you're making a lot of guesses. I enjoy that. I mean, I could write for piano, an instrument I know completely, and know just how it'll sound, and that'll be that. But with the orchestra, there is a certain magical not knowing, which I feel brings out a kind of fantasy and daring I would not otherwise be prey to.
Now, you're working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic. Will the orchestra make itself available to you if you want to hear a sketch of a section that you're working on?
What a dream. Never, because the world of the orchestra is so expensive. You know, 20 minutes of orchestral time of a rehearsal would cost out of the blue. No, there is no time. It's not like a playwright writing a play and saying, I want to have a reading and gathering the actors together and sort of seeing how it flows and changing a word or a phrase or a speech to the here or there. That can't happen with an orchestral piece. I mean, I may take 2 years to write it, but the rehearsals will begin 3 days before the performance, and that's it. It'll suddenly be thrown into my face, all of these thoughts. It's really quite a frightening time, and I often get quite physically sick during that first rehearsal. And I tell people, chain me to a chair and gag me, and don't let me say a thing. Because I've learned that with a great orchestra, in 3 days, they can go from not knowing it to a superb performance. I mean, they're real professionals, and they're geared to learn that quickly.
Have you ever gotten into a fight with a conductor about how a piece should be interpreted?
Always. That's why
you want to be gagged.
De rigueur. No, that's part of the game. In fact, when I conduct my own music, I'm sort of disappointed. I have nobody to fight with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Are you going to head back to your piano now?
You make it sound like jail.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
We checked, and David Del Tredici is still at the piano working on his commissions. Tomorrow, we continue our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Richard Price reveals he's not Mr. Macho tough guy like his readers assume he is. Price's novels include The Wanderers and Blood Brothers, and he wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money and Sea of Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is an excerpt of John Cage's Sonata No. 2 for Prepared Piano.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor and writer Wallace Shawn played himself in his 1981 film, My Dinner with Andre. His roles have ranged from a priest to a criminal mastermind in such films as Crackers, The Princess Bride, Manhattan, and We're No Angels. Coming up, we open the Fresh Air archives and meet Wally Shawn. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, who usually has just the right word on the tip of his tongue, tells us what he went through picking the right name for his new daughter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. In Romania, warring factions loyal to executed President Nicolae Ceaușescu have been given an ultimatum. Romania's provisional government says they should give up their arms or face the firing squad. According to Romanian broadcast, members of the secret police have been randomly shooting at officials and civilians in Bucharest and other cities. The new U.S.-backed government of Panama faces its first foreign relations quandary as the diplomatic standoff surrounding Manuel Noriega continues. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The new government of Panama called on the Vatican Embassy today in Panama City to turn out Manuel Noriega because he's, quote, a common criminal. But the new president, Guillermo Endara, stopped short of asking the Vatican to turn Noriega over to Panamanian justice or to U.S. troops. Though Panama has no extradition treaty with the United States, Washington continues to demand that Noriega be extradited. The Vatican and Rome has replied decisively, no. The diplomats continue to search for a third country that would accept Noriega, with the U.S. insisting that he ultimately be jailed. In other developments, U.S. troops are sweeping outlying neighborhoods looking for arms and searching for Noriega loyalists that want to give themselves up. Gunfire in the capital has all but ceased, probably owing to the heavy presence of U.S. armored vehicles at intersections throughout Panama City. In Panama City, this is John Burnett reporting.
The Defense Department is continuing to airlift humanitarian supplies to Panama. Most of the food should reach Panama City by tomorrow. Pentagon officials say the supplies include food, medicine, and blankets. In addition, the Pentagon says some 698 tons of ready-to-eat food have already arrived, and another 70 tons were to reach the Panamanian capital today. A suspected package bomb was found this morning in the federal building in Greenville, Mississippi. Pat O'Brien reports from Greenville.
The federal building and surrounding businesses were evacuated for about 2 hours. A postal worker who asked not to be identified told a local television reporter that the package was addressed to the principal of the largest black school. Greenville's public school system is mostly black. Officials were quoted as saying the X-ray showed what appeared to be a bomb in the 8 to 10 pound package. As of 5 o'clock this afternoon, officials still will not confirm if the package does actually contain a bomb. A postmaster that was flown in from Memphis earlier today has yet to give the decision on whether to open the package or to try to deactivate the suspected bomb. Reporting for National Public Radio, I'm Pat O'Brien in Greenville, Mississippi.
A suspicious package that was delivered to the home of a county judge in North Carolina turned out only to be a doll. A Mecklenburg County District Judge found the package on his porch this morning. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 15 points to close at 2724.40. Advances led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. We're ending the decade by featuring a series of interviews from Fresh Air's 1980s archives. Wallace Shawn was a little-known playwright when he gained a national following in 1981 for his film My Dinner with Andre. He co-wrote and co-starred in the film with avant-garde theater director Andre Gregory. Throughout the decade, Shawn has also established himself as a quirky character actor. He plays a smug church bureaucrat in the new comedy We're No Angels. In The Princess Bride, he was the criminal mastermind who kidnaps the princess. He's also appeared in Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, Hotel New Hampshire, Crackers, Starting Over, and Manhattan. Shawn is the son of William Shawn, who edited the New Yorker magazine for many years. Wallace Shawn wants his plays to be shocking and confrontational, but his film, My Dinner with Andre, shows a benign, withdrawn side of him. Almost the entire movie is set at a restaurant dinner table where Shawn and Gregory, who play themselves, debate about theater and the meaning of life. Gregory describes why he left the theater to travel around the world in search of mystical experiences. Wally argues on behalf of the pleasures of staying home and reading Charlton Heston's autobiography. In a 1985 interview, Sean told me he's not really like the version of himself that he created for the film.
In order to make the movie an interesting piece and something that people could stand to watch for 2 hours, obviously we had to create a conflict between the two characters. And seeing as I was the person who constructed the script, you might say, I had to figure out how to distort us in order to make us into two people who would come into conflict and whose resolution would be somewhat, you'd feel suspense about what would happen. So I made myself into a sort of super terrified little homebody, and everything that I have tried to get away from in myself in terms of being overly cautious in life, I put into the character. But still, the character I created was kind of appealing. And an awful lot of people have met me and been somewhat disappointed.
Were you warned when you were writing My Dinner with Andre that nobody would either produce or go to see a movie that was almost entirely set in a restaurant at a dinner table with two people talking?
I had never really had a successful project. So the idea that this one would not be successful was not, terribly upsetting.
You had to play yourself in the movie. Was that hard to do? You'd already acted in other roles in films, but you never played a slightly fictionalized version of yourself before. Was it hard to, like, learn the lines that you'd already actually said in real life, more or less, and to play yourself, but not quite yourself, a little bit different than yourself?
Well, our director, Louis Malle, encouraged us to forget that it had anything to do with us, because I think he found that it was just unbelievably boring if we did what we would really do if Andre and I were having dinner together. And so Louis basically had to convince me that it should be played with a little more feeling shown than would be shown in life, and yet that it would look quite lifelike. And in fact, we rehearsed for a few months on video so that he could show that he was right about this point and others, which he always was.
One of the kind of running themes in the conversation that you're having with Andre Gregory in it is whether you have to actually leave the theater to experience the kind of experience that theater hopes to provide. And he left the theater in search of more exotic experiences like rebirth ceremonies and studying with mystics in faraway places and things like that. And you were arguing that, and he argued that to experience a real decapitation in theater, you should actually pass around a decapitated head from a morgue so the audience really experiences firsthand what that's like. And you were arguing that all of that is unnecessary. Now, I think that the film, in its own way, proves that you're right, because here it is just a conversation with two people, where audiences, for the most part, walked away feeling that something quite remarkable had happened, and there were no decapitated heads getting passed through the audience. There was nothing really exotic happening. It was just basically like theater, except that it was in the movies. Do you think that in that sense that the movie kind of proves the points that you were making, that you don't need that kind of exoticism in the theater to reach people?
Well, it is quite convincing, although I myself tend to hold the opposite view. My own plays are a little bit closer to passing around the real head. My Dinner with Andre, in that sense, is kind of an exception in my work.
How are your plays like passing around the head?
Well, I suppose I just take it for granted in a certain way that plays should be enormously upsetting to people, or it isn't even worth writing them. Now, I don't know why I've always sort of, I seem to have assumed that for a long time. When I'm writing, if I've written a page that really agitates me so that it makes me just sick, I sort of think, oh, well, this is a good day's work. But I think that theater right now tends to be so fantastically cozy and sort of comfortable padded cell or something that it just goes against my grain not to be terribly abrasive and shake people by the lapels.
Now, people come to the theater in a way. They spend their hard-earned money for a night out.
Right.
And frequently go to the theater to get away from those things that they're forced to confront every day.
Right.
And if they go to one of your plays, you're going to confront them with things that they don't want to confront. So do audiences ever get angry if they're not prepared for that kind of experience?
Yes, and I understand that. I feel, on the conscious level, that I have absolutely no desire to agitate the people who really are just tired and want a little diversion and have paid money to have a pleasant experience that will soothe them before they go to bed.
The plays that you write are so different. I'm just thinking, you know, knowing that your father is William Shawn, who edits The New Yorker, that your plays are just the opposite in their confrontational style and in their use of, you know, frequently obscene language. They're just the opposite of the polish and refinement and control that you expect from The New Yorker. And I just wonder if you think that there's any conscious or unconscious reason why your style is so divergent from The New Yorker style.
Well, I suppose there must be some connection, but I really wouldn't know quite how to go about describing it. I mean, it's true that The New Yorker doesn't go in for describing sex very explicitly, or there are certain things that they just don't write about. Of course, to me, my writing is actually quite refined, but it just happens to deal with some hot subjects. And I sort of would trace the influence more the other way and say, well, I mean, this, it is kind of obscene in certain passages, but it's also very grammatical and is also very sort of refined in certain ways.
When you temporarily left theater to do the screenplay and then act in My Dinner with Andre, was that an attempt on your part to, like, get away from the theater for a while? Were you wanting to get out? Were you disappointed with or maybe even disgusted with the theater at that time?
I really only have written sort of one play every 4 years anyway. That's just all that I have to say. I've basically had a fairly uncomfortable relation with theater. I don't think I fit in terribly well. I mean, my plays have basically been done in New York, and people across the country have generally not wanted to do them. So it's not that I dropped out exactly. It's just a limited interest in my work.
We're listening to an interview recorded in 1985 with actor and writer Wallace Shawn. It's part of our End of the Decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Wally Shawn. I guess it was in part because your plays weren't paying a lot of money that you started acting in movies. Your first movie role was in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Did you get along well with Woody Allen? Did you feel like you shared any common sensibility with him?
Well, we only met for 45 minutes. I was just in one scene. So I wouldn't say that we have a deep lasting relationship, but I don't know what he thinks about me, but I feel totally indebted to him, really. I mean, certainly My Dinner with Andre you know, it just wouldn't have really quite... I just don't think one would have thought of doing it, really, without his influence. There's
where does he fit into that?
He's expanded one's ideas of what can go into a movie. I admire him just enormously.
Do you think casting directors have you in mind for a certain type of character at this point, since you're becoming better known?
Unfortunately, I think so, yes.
You know, one of the things that bothers me about movies is that unless you're a kind of standardly handsome type person, you'll never get a romantic lead. and you're never even allowed to be sexual unless you fit the kind of current face of what's good looking.
I'm afraid this is brutally true. Well, I mean to say it shifts and expands a little bit, but you know, basically that's true, and you can become quite concerned about it after a while, because you can begin to think, gosh, am I really so monstrous, so grotesque that no one can imagine me in a romantic relationship with another human being? Am I such a horrifying monstrosity as that? You can become sort of agitated about it, because if you're cast repeatedly in the same roles, or you're not cast in the ones that you think you should be cast, you begin to think, well, do the people really see me this way? Is this what I really am, or whatever?
Are there roles that you turn down?
Yeah. Mainly, I turn down things that offend me or that I object to from a moral point of view. There are certain things that are obvious. This movie makes fun of gay people, reinforces stereotypes about black people, encourages an audience to enjoy violence. There are certain obvious things. But then I also turn down things if they're just too stupid, if they're so idiotic that you sort of feel, well, this is destroying people's minds because it's so idiotic. It's just so stupid. And also I turn down certain things where the little guy the people listening to this don't know I myself happen to be a little person, and there's quite a cliche in films that the little guy gets bullied, beaten up, thrown down the stairs, kicked, lifted up by the big guy or whatever, and smacked around. This is considered funny. And, well, it's quite amazing how many scripts you get as a short actor in which the short guy is beaten up or whatever. Now, that's bullying, and the audience is encouraged to find it funny. So I tend to turn those down.
You had to work for a while as a Xerox operator and a shipping clerk in order to make money to support yourself while you were writing plays. And what really shocked me is I was looking up, I think it was the Contemporary Theater Biographies, and it says in it, under your entry, you know, 19 blah, blah, blah through blah, 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 Xerox operator, and it names the name of the company, and then it names the company that you did shipping for. And I figured, did he want this in? Did he ask that this be included in his biography and Contemporary Theater bios? So, did you?
Well, they asked what your profession was, I suppose. And I mean, in a certain way, there's I suppose there's a certain kind of not necessarily very attractive bravado about this, because the reality is that I have, come from an what you might call an upper-class background, and it's been by my own choice that I have done these things that have superficially made me not seem to be a member of the ruling class.
You know, that reminds me of one of the opening scenes in My Dinner with Andre, when you walk into a very expensive restaurant that Andre Gregory has chosen for you to meet at. And you come in wearing a slightly rumpled trench coat, and you're not dressed up or anything, and you look like you're feeling very out of place in this restaurant, where Andre breezes in, and he's just wearing a sweater, but it doesn't matter he's casually dressed, because he's at home in this place of expense and elegance, because he knows how to behave in it. You know, he's just like one of them, even though he lives separate from it. And really, though, you grew up in a background where you could have been very at home in that. I mean, have you purposely tried to disassociate yourself from coming from, I guess, an upper middle class background?
From the time I was 13, I have always felt uncomfortable with the upper middle class world. I never felt that I was a part of it or wanted to be a part of it. It was in my Dinner with Andre that was sort of a coming out for me, because in the movie I admit that I came from a fancy background and don't. I mean, that's one of the things I like about the movie, is that it's a portrait of the dilettante children of that class in a certain way, if you want to look at it that way. You can look at the whole thing as a social satire, and that's why it's set in a fancy restaurant, and that's why we have the waiter who is actually working while we're philosophizing and so on. And I think for both Andre and me, it took a certain nerve to, instead of hiding from that, as I think we both always had, to sort of admit that.
What's embarrassing about it?
Well, being a member of the ruling class of the United States of America is sort of extremely awkward position to be in, and one doesn't want to see oneself that way. It's ultimately you don't particularly want to be the slave master holding the whip. You don't want to think, well, those peasants who are working the sugarcane fields for 10 cents a day in South America are working for me. You don't sort of want to feel that if you happen to think that the world shouldn't be organized in that way.
Actor and writer Wallace Shawn from a 1985 interview, part of our series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. By the way, you can see Wallace Shawn in the new comedy, We're No Angels. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have the latest from Panama and also from Romania. And we'll be talking as well with a member of Sąjūdis, the Lithuanian National Front, to get their reaction to the news that Mikhail Gorbachev is going to Lithuania to try to see what communists there think and try to talk them out of their move for an independent party. Also, a report from NPR's Daniel Zwerdling in Kenya about Operation Smile, Western plastic surgeons performing operations in Kenya in the Third World. And also a talk with Moondog. Do you remember Moondog?
Sure do. He was dressed up like a Viking on the corner of a Manhattan street.
For years, he's been living in Germany. He no longer wears the Viking suit.
Okay, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are many anxieties connected with having your first child, not the least of which is picking a name. Today, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us about the choice of Sophie.
As soon as we knew it was going to be a girl, we started looking for a name in earnest. Men's names are like men's ties. There are only about six of them, and you run into the same ones over and over again. Bob, Bill, Steve, Tom, Bill, Steve, John, Bill, Mike. Whereas girls' names are like women's fashions, more fanciful, more varied, and much easier to screw up on. Naming a girl child is sort of like buying a trousseau 20 years in advance. I wanted something vaguely old-fashioned and Middle European, sort of a feminine version of Max or Emil, which would sidle up nicely to Nunberg. But my wife is French and wanted something that worked in that language as well. She vetoed Louise and Paula, which was probably just as well. I told her that Geraldine might be very well in French, but that it was out of the question in America so long as there are people alive who remember Flip Wilson. We toyed with Isabel and Adele, then hit on Sophie, which seemed an ideal solution. Sophie for the new world, Sophie for the old. I had the first inkling that there might be a problem when my friend Greg the painter was out visiting from New York. Greg is my pipeline to the cutting edge. He asked me if we had a name for the baby yet. Then, before I could answer, he said, "Wait, don't tell me you're going to call her Sophie." I was taken aback, to put it mildly. "How'd you guess that?" "Look," he said, "these things are in the air. You could be in a cave in Alaska for 10 years, and then your wife gets pregnant, and you say, 'I've got it, we'll call the kid Blair.'" I tried to put this out of my mind, but it made me nervous. And then, just 2 weeks before the baby was due, we were watching an episode of 30-something, where one of the characters had gotten herself a cat and named it Sophie. I began to fear that we'd hit on the Jennifer of the 90s. Strange, the way the collective mind works. Here are all these prospective parents poring over name books while they practice their breathing. They've spent all their lives being ruled by language, constrained to call things by the names that other people gave them. Now they have the opportunity to label one little bundle of reality with whatever name strikes their fancy. And as if by magic, they all stop on the same page. I thought about what it would be like in nursery school with two or three other Sophies, a Lindsay and a Chelsea, and a clutch of Chloes and Zoes with diarises dancing over their curls. And what would happen 40 years later? Was Sophie going to be one of those names that are so tied to a particular decade that they wind up as markers of dowdy middle age, like Mildred, Ethel, and Flo? We went with Sophie anyway. Even if it turns out to be trendy, she'll make it her own. You only have to look at her to know that. After all, Doris Day is no ordinary Doris, and Audrey Hepburn makes you rethink Audrey. And whatever you associate with Marilyn, you make at least one exception. Sophie Nunberg, you heard it here first.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our interviews from the archives were edited by Maeve McGoran and Karen Impola. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our end-of-the-decade series with more interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Richard Price, now best known for his screenplays For the Color of Money and Sea of Love, tells us how rock and roll influenced his writing, and rocker Elvis Costello performs one of his songs. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.